March 15th marks the 7th anniversary of the civilian uprising in Syria. It's a conflict that has unraveled the nation, killed hundreds of thousands of people. The UN actually stopped counting the casualties. It's also reinvigorated Islamic extremism, caused one of the worst refugee and humanitarian crises of our time. While some have escaped the fighting, others are trapped, and they have lived, protested, and died in the course of the revolution. Prize-winning journalist Rania Abuzaid witnessed the first demonstrations in 2011 and spent the next 7 years illegally trekking across the Syrian border to continue documenting the experiences of those inside the country. Her heartbreakingly honest book, No Turning Back, Life, Loss, and Hope in Wartime Syria, is published by W.W. Norton & Company. I spoke with Rania Abuzaid last March, and we're rebroadcasting that conversation for you now. You write that in Syria, this revolution began timidly with small public gatherings, including one on February 23rd, 2011, in front of the Libyan embassy in Damascus. You were there, right?
Yes, I was.
What'd you see?
Initially, there were very small public gatherings. There were no more than 200 people, and that was considered one of the larger gatherings at the time. And they were trying to get to the Libyan embassy to show solidarity with Libyan protesters. And there had been an earlier protest in front of the Egyptian embassy as well for the same purpose. So they weren't talking about the regime. They weren't bringing up Syria. They were trying to show solidarity with the people who were protesting in other parts of the Arab world. And they weren't, they couldn't even make it to the embassy because many different layers of the Syrian security state stood between them and the embassy. And I went there a little bit earlier. There was a fast food restaurant just opposite the Libyan embassy. And for me, that was an excuse to stand there and to try and see what was happening. So I ate very slowly and watched the a number of different arms of the Syrian security forces mobilize. And what happened was that the protesters were in a nearby park. They couldn't get to the embassy, but they started chanting there. And very soon after, the Syrian regime broke it up by force.
All protests had been banned in Syria under an emergency law from 1963, right?
Yes.
So what began to happen? How did this snowball?
Some people, because not all Syrians were with the revolution, some people wanted to test the boundaries of what the Syrian state would accept. Any sort of public gatherings required state approval. So these were just small, tentative, timid, careful attempts to see what they could get away with in public. And that's how it started.
At the time, Bashar al-Assad had been president for 11 years. How did people feel about his administration at the time?
Well, he was his father's son in many ways. He was an Assad. He took over from his late father, Hafez, who had quite an iron-ruled approach to governance. But people thought that Bashar al-Assad is a younger man, that he might be a reformer, that he was a modernizer, that he might have different ideas. And that was initially what people thought. But I remember after the revolution kicked off, some of the Syrians who were part of the revolution looked to Bashar al-Assad himself to try and bring reforms to the country. They initially called for reforms, not regime change, and they hoped that the man who helmed the regime would create those reforms. But in late March, when Bashar al-Assad gave his first public speech, when his first comments really about what was happening in the country, it quickly became clear that he was not going to allow these protests to continue.
And we should say he's from one specific group of people inside Syria, right? Can you talk about that a little bit?
He is. He's from the Alawite sect. However, to be clear, his regime also has members of other sects in Syria. So it's certainly Alawite-led, and Alawites play a prominent role, but it's by no means solely Alawite at all. There are many, many Sunnis. And the fact is that most of Syria is Sunni, more than 70%. So most of the Syrian army that is fighting for Bashar al-Assad is Sunni. So it's not quite that sectarian. I mean, there are sectarian elements, of course, to the fighting, and with any civil conflict, and when it continues for a long time, people start to look at the differences between the various sides to try and magnify them, to make them, some Syrians, the other. And it becomes easier to look at these differences and say, well, they're not quite like us because they're X. And that might be sect, it might be geography, it might be socioeconomic. Whatever it is, to dehumanize the enemy in front of you is a tool that some people will use in civil conflicts.
You know, your first chapter begins with the story of a character named Suleiman. Tell me a little bit about who he was. Who was he in February 2011?
He was a young man on a date in March. That's how I opened the book, and it's a quiet opening because it reflects the fact that it was a quiet, timid start to the Syrian uprising.
And he's Alawite.
He's a Sunni, actually.
Oh, so I thought he was Alawite.
He's a Sunni, but he's from a prominent family that had connections to the regime. He's a rich man. He was a man with everything. He had opportunities that many Syrians could only hope for. He had money, he had connections, he had a great job, he had prospects.
But what speaks to him about what he's seeing?
He knew that he was a privileged young man and that many people didn't have his opportunities, and he didn't think that was right. So that's why he took to the streets.
Yeah, so he's on this date, and then it goes from there, he's at mosque, right?
Yes.
And what happens?
He hears a cry in the mosque, and somebody shouts out, "We want freedom." Mm. And this is very soon after the start of the uprising, and he suddenly, it's as if it unlocked something deep within him. It unlocked that desire that he had. To change things, and it broke his wall of fear, and he marched, and that was the first time that he protested.
And he began videotaping, right?
He did. He wanted to document what was happening in his hometown, because when he was on that date, March 15th, 2011, the date that is considered the start of the Syrian uprising, he saw the protests broadcast on satellite TV. And it moved him. And he felt like if this was going to be happening in his hometown, it was a duty, and that's the word that he used, to document what was happening.
And this was a town that was fairly loyal, right?
Yes. He was from Rastan, and Rastan is a town that is halfway between Homs and Hama. And it was considered a town of military sons because the defense minister, Syria's longest-serving defense minister, who was Suleiman's relative, by the way, that's why he had strong connections to the regime. He came from Rastan. So Rastan was known for its military officers and for its perceived loyalty to the regime.
Huh. How did you find him?
I was there.
Yeah.
That's how I found him and so many other people. I was documenting Syria very intensively for a long time, and I met a lot of people. Suleiman is one of them, but there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of others, some of whom were documented in my journalism, some are mentioned in the book, and some I just didn't have the space to tell their stories.
Did Suleiman have the blessing of his family to do what he was doing, recording these protests, and then he would go back and upload them and send them, right?
Yes, he would disseminate the information on the internet. His parents, whom I know, were terrified because they knew what the consequences would be if he were caught. So they were quietly supportive. Well, his father was anyway. His mother was just plain terrified and wanted him to stop doing what he was doing. It was very risky. It was very daring. It was very frightening. And it was very brave.
Was it clear what he wanted to change about Syria?
He wanted more people to have the opportunities that he had.
Huh. To have the privilege that he had.
To have the privilege, to have the opportunity to attain the things that he had. That's what he was fighting for. He wanted Syria's a one-party state. He wanted political openness. He wanted the things that so many of us in the West take for granted.
You know, what was most interesting to me about this book is that it really makes clear how many different ideas of Syria are being fought over. And I really realized that when you tell the story of an Al-Qaeda sympathizer named Mohammed.
Yes.
Who was he?
Mohammed is Sulaiman's opposite. He saw a dark opportunity in the protests. He was radicalized as a youth, but he kept his ideas very close to his chest. And when the uprising kicked off, he saw that as an opportunity to try and implement his vision of Syria, which was very different from Sulaiman's vision.
What was his vision?
His vision was an Islamic State in Syria, and he has a very sectarian worldview. So he had a very different ideas, and what you say is, thank you for seeing that in the book, because there were many different streams that were moving at the same time concurrently. There were people like Sulaiman, there were people like Muhammad, and there were people, you know, just regular people who were caught in the middle of it all.
You know, you use Muhammad's story to talk about the larger policy issues in Syria, because you talk about how Syria had been a gateway to Iraq for fighters. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I used Muhammad's story, and the way that I sort of structured the book is that I have four main characters, and other characters branch off them. And Muhammad's character storyline is that of Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, and I present new details about the Islamization of the uprising and how it happened, how Al-Qaeda split with Islamic State, and I retell those details from the people who were involved on the ground at various levels of these militant groups. So Muhammad, as I said, was radicalized very early on, and he continued throughout the Iraq war, for example, when there were foreign fighters who were using Syrian territory, to get into Iraq to fight the Americans in Iraq. Muhammad's brother went to fight, and he ended up fighting with Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So he had a long family history of this sort of Islamic militancy.
What was it like to report alongside him as a woman who seems fairly Western? How do you carry yourself? How do you do that?
I carefully. That's the first thing. Carefully. It's funny, you know, because after a while they stop viewing me as a woman, and I just become, sometimes they actually call me brother. It's the funniest thing.
Really?
Yes, they do, because that's how they address each other.
Huh.
So after a while, gender becomes almost invisible to a certain degree, and they just view you as the journalist. And I had a lot of interactions with men like Muhammad and some of his colleagues, others who were also in ultra-conservative Islamist groups. And I was actually the first journalist to interview a fighter in Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Syrian al-Qaeda branch, or it was, and also an official in the group. So I had those connections with these men, and it wasn't a problem that I was a woman. I could get past what some people would consider as an obstacle to dealing with men like this.
You tell this one, there's this one line that was such a telling detail to me, where you're walking along with Muhammad and he's leading you up a hill, and he can't touch women, and so he extends his Kalashnikov to you.
Yes.
And it takes him a couple times to realize it's loaded.
Yes.
It was an amazing detail of like what life is like and how deeply connected to war everything is.
Yes. No. You know, I'm not the fittest person. And we were walking up a hill, and it was in the middle of a ferocious battle, and there were helicopter gunships overhead and fighter jets, the regime's helicopter gunships and fighter jets. And I remember that there was a smell of burning trees because of the firepower and all of the shelling. So we were in a bit of a rush. And he was trying to help me up the hill, but he wouldn't touch a woman who he wasn't related to. So he did extend the barrel of his Kalashnikov. And it was just one of those, was one of those scenes that tells you something about his character. And that's why I put that in there, because I'm not in the book. I'm not a character, and my presence is absolutely minimal, except in circumstances like that where my interaction with a character reveals something about that character. And that was my prerequisite, I guess, for recounting anecdotes like that.
I'm Mary Harris. I am speaking with Rania Abuzaid about her new book, No Turning Back, Life, Loss, and Hope in Wartime Syria. This is Midday on WNYC. We're going to be right back after a break. Back with an interview I had with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Rania Abuzaid about her book No Turning Back, Life, Loss, and Hope in Wartime Syria, published by W.W. Norton & Company. When we returned from the break, I asked Rania about Muhammad, one of the men she reported with for several years. I asked her how she was able to write about him with such honesty and empathy, especially when she wrote about the way he was traumatized by violence he witnessed as a child.
Yeah, I didn't. I wanted to maintain an even keel. I didn't want to turn characters into caricatures. And for me, in my journalism and in the book, I'm not interested in demonizing or glorifying people. I just want to try and understand them, and I want readers to try and understand them without my input. So that's the approach that I took in the book. He witnessed something in the early 80s. He, at the time, the regime was fought and won against an Islamist insurgency that culminated in the killings of tens of thousands of people in the city of Hama. And for years after that, it was a Muslim Brotherhood-led insurgency. And for years after that, the regime went around hunting perceived sympathizers or members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And Muhammad's relatives were among the Muslim Brotherhood sympathizers, let me say. But what he saw was his neighbor humiliated and arrested. And he says that was the day that they planted hatred in me. And that was the first step in his radicalization process.
And then what stands out to me is then he continues that with his work, with what he does. He spreads that. And does he connect those things?
I asked him that. I asked him that directly. I told him that you were the little boy who saw these mukhabarat, the secret police, the Syrian secret police. And you watch them with fear, and you say that they planted hatred in your heart that day. Do you think about how you're doing the same thing to other boys, the fear that you're instilling in other boys and what you've done to other men, to other fathers and sons and brothers? And he answered it, and he answered it honestly, and he said he doesn't care. He doesn't care because, in his view, they're the oppressors, and hence they deserve it. I mean, he becomes what radicalized him. It's about this cycle of violence that that continues, and it's about how he really did become what he feared as a child.
Did being with him for so much time give you insights into how to reach men like him? You know, I feel like we have a tremendous problem of people who are radicalized, and it's very unclear how we reach them. So I wonder if you got any insights from your work.
I think the first step is to understand them, to find out why they are the way that they are. What is it about their life experience? What is it about this ideology and their connection to it. And it has to start with that. It has to start with an honest look at it, far from all sorts of language that is far from opinion, whatever it is that you think of them. If you want to combat them, you have to understand them first.
You introduce us to someone else, Mohammed Daher, better known as Abu Azam. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Okay. He was a fourth-year Arabic literature student. So what happened with him in the revolution?
He was a poet. He was a poet and a student in Homs. And Homs was known as the capital of the revolution back in 2011 because of the protests and eventually the armed resistance to the regime. And he became embroiled in all of that. So his path is once again very different from the other characters in the book.
He'd already spent a little bit of time in jail.
Yes, he had been picked up for suspicion of being a conservative Muslim.
Huh.
He wasn't, and his family wasn't, and in fact they despise the ultra-conservative Muslims. But, you know, that didn't keep him out of jail. I think he was incarcerated about 13 times, if I'm not mistaken. So he had that experience, but despite having that experience, he took a very different path from Muhammad. And I put him in there for that reason, because it's not just, you know, Muhammad saw something. It didn't even happen to him initially. He was in prison as an adult, but he took one path, and Abu Azam took a very different path, and he has a very different ideology, and he has, at least initially, very different views to Muhammad.
So what happened to him in prison? How did he come out changed?
Abu Azam?
Yeah.
If anything, it instilled fear in him. He didn't, he wasn't radicalized the way that Muhammad was in prison. He was against all of that. And he had one uncle. He was the only one in the family who was an ultra-conservative Islamist. And whenever, and Abu Azam used to call him the fanatic. So he really didn't find anything in that ideology that appealed to him. And he, like Muhammad, had also spent time in jail, but it didn't lead him on the path that Muhammad took.
So when the protests began, how did that seed that was planted, that sort of anti-regime seed, how did it sprout?
Because he saw what was happening in Homs. He had friends who were detained, some of whom were killed. And he didn't want that to happen to him. He didn't think it was right. And the one thing that he initially had to counter that was his voice, at least initially.
So this is a story about the people of Syria, but it's also a story of you as a journalist. You said you very particularly did not put yourself in there. But at the beginning and the end, you talk about the meticulous work you had to do to get these stories out of Syria. You were actually blacklisted by Damascus in the summer of 2011. Why?
I don't know why. I still don't know why. Because I have no way to appeal that. I found out that I was banned from entering the country, and that I was wanted by three of the state's four intelligence agencies. I was branded a spy working for a number of states. And
how did you hear that?
I heard that there were leaked lists of Syrian activists. My name was on it, and then there were the files. I learned of the file numbers, the case numbers, and then human rights organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch called me up to warn me that they knew that my name was on these lists, and then I asked people who are close to the Syrian regime, whom I know, to confirm it, and they were like, "Yes, you can't go because X, Y, and Z." So I got it from a number of sources, and I'm still banned, and I'm still on those lists.
Was it obvious to you what to do next?
I had to keep covering it. It was important. It is important. For me, obviously, it made my work harder. But for me, there was no question that I had to cover it. What was going to happen in Syria was going to be momentous, one way or the other, because of Syria's geostrategic, geopolitical role and position in the Middle East. It was going to be important.
You didn't have any doubt about going in. You didn't have any, like, how do you even prepare to go into the country when you know that you're a wanted person?
Once again, carefully, very low key, very low profile. Don't tweet. Don't put anything on Facebook. Don't let anybody know where you are until you've left that place. Don't advertise what you're doing to anybody, not to the hotel people in Turkey, not to anybody. You have to be very under the radar, and you have to be careful, and you have to know where you're going inside Syria, know who you're going with, know the terrain, understand everything about the place that you're going into so that you can operate, and you can operate as low-key as you need to be to get in there, get the story, get out.
What did you tell your family when you were leaving for these reporting trips?
You know, often I wouldn't tell them. But I've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing it for well over 15 years, closer to 20. I just don't want to admit that it ages me. But I've been doing this for a while, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, all sorts of different places. And on one level, they're sort of a little bit used to me doing this. But on the other level, I'm still their daughter, their sister. It's still difficult. So I try to minimize what I tell them until after I'm out, and then I'm like, okay, I'm fine. I mean, I do check in.
Yeah.
When I'm in a place like Syria, I'll check in with them. But they don't need to know the specifics.
You know, one of the scenes that just really got me in this book is a scene, it's like midway through, I think, at a field hospital. You introduce a character named Dr. Rami Habib. How did you meet him?
How did I meet him? I was in the town. I mean, I knew that town. And I was in the town, and I went to the field hospital, and I met him, and I saw the work that he was doing, and the work that he continued doing even after his hospital was bombed. And he's an amazing character, because he's a doctor. He could have been anywhere. He had studied in the UK, and he stayed. And he stayed under fire. He stayed, I mean, the hospital, it was an apartment building. It was a field hospital. It had already been bombed. Its upper floors were pancaked on top of each other. But he stayed there along with his dedicated team. And he treated everyone that he could. And he's one example of the many field hospitals that are in Syria.
You said he treated anyone. Who was in the field hospital? Who was coming in? Was it all sides?
Well, I don't want to give too much away in the book, but he had occasion to treat prisoners who were perceived as close to the regime.
Was there anyone he would refuse to treat?
Not when I saw him, no. And I've known him for years. It wasn't just the one thing. I've known him for many years, and he's not the only one. He's, you know, been out there in the field trying to help. And like I said, his hospital was bombed more than once, and he continues his work.
Have you followed up with him since that meeting?
I am in contact with everybody who is still alive in the book, and people who aren't in the book. I'm still in contact with people who I interacted with intensely in Iraq 10 years ago. I don't want people to ever think that they're just quotes in my stories, especially people who I spend some time with. I mean, obviously, I can't do that with everybody that I talk to. But for people who I spend time with, I check in with them. I want to see how they're doing. I'll send them, you know, greetings at New Year's and things like that, just to remind them that I see them as full people.
You've just published this book. Have any of them seen it?
Not yet.
I don't know. Those will be interesting texts to kind of. Do they don't know necessarily about the other characters in the book?
No,
and how
they
it comes
don't.
Out.
No, in fact, some of them don't even know about the connections between them.
Huh.
And their connections that I uncovered in my reporting, in my investigative reporting, when I was trying to map out the arming and the Islamization of the uprising. I have a number of Al-Qaeda characters in the book, and they don't know that I know.
What are the connections that you found?
I know them independently. There were some connections that, you know, as a journalist, when you're reporting and you hear a connection and you just hear this sound in your head, like, cha-ching, I got it. there were a few like that. There were a few that were just incredibly happy coincidences, and that these people were the link that I was looking for sometimes in a story. Just from digging and digging and digging, and I came to realize that they were connected.
What do you hope people reading this book will take from it?
People often ask me, what's it like? What's it like over there? I want them to see what it's like. I want them to hear it. I want them to feel it. I want them to experience it with all of their senses. And I also want them to know that Syrians aren't numbers. And even though the UN has stopped counting Syria's dead, they're people. And in some cases, I mean, yes, Muhammad is an al-Qaeda member, and he's obviously not somebody you can relate to. But there are some people who are not so very different from us.
Do you feel like people don't feel it now?
I think that people have become numb, that there's a numbness, and people know that there's something terrible happening in Syria. It's a war. It's they see the images on TV. But to really know what happens to a person, and that's why I wrote the book in the way that I did. I sort of weave in and out between these different character stories. And I do so over an extended period because I want them to see. I don't want them to see a character in a moment in time and then just move on. I want them to see them over a span of time, to understand how people change, what happens to people, what they overcome, and not just in a moment, but, you know, over an extended period to really understand them.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, once again, it's about understanding fundamentally, not sympathizing with necessarily or despising or demonizing, just to understand.
Do you still have hope that the conflict can come to any kind of positive resolution?
I don't know if what's positive in a war when, if the UN stopped counting years ago and they said that 500,000 people were dead, and that's a figure that has been static for years, at least officially, so obviously it's much higher than that. Half of the country has been displaced. At least 500,000 people are dead. So I'm not sure. The country has splintered. Some parts are ruled by the regime. Others, there's a Kurdish enclave. There was until recently an Islamic State enclave. There are rebel-held parts. I'm not sure what kind of positivity. I mean, I don't see positivity, but every conflict eventually comes to an end. The question is just, what will it take to get there?
What do you think it'll take to get there?
I don't know. I really don't. I don't know.
I'm Mary Harris. I have been speaking with Rania Abuzaid about her new book, No Turning Back, Life, Loss, and Hope in Wartime Syria. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.